From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, there are a lot of people who complain about liberal Hollywood and their opinions, but when you really get down to it, almost no one is speaking up.
Comedy icon Judd Apatow's latest film is The King of Staten Island, and we are going to talk about that. But we're also going to talk about Apatow's decidedly unfunny presence on Twitter. As his more than 2 million followers know, Apatow regularly rains scorn, not only on Donald Trump, but on Fox CEO Lachlan Murdoch, whose news network relentlessly bolsters the administration. And Apatow wonders why others in the entertainment industry don't do the same. Apatow explains why he has no fear about taking a stand on political issues and tells us why he thinks comedies still have a place on the big screen. And yes, we talk about The King of Staten Island, now available on demand. But first on the news banter, Oscars so pushed. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, the TV networks are releasing all sorts of varied plans for the fall season or not the fall season. Some of them are pushing. Some of them are recycling what they call gently used shows. Some of them are pretending everything's fine and they're going to have a fall season. Meanwhile, however, the real point of the fall season is ad dollars, as you know. The upfronts are usually in May. They usually then start to sell these ads for the TV season that's coming up. The big networks do. There is an analysis from eMarketer that is kind of shocking, which shows prediction that revenue from the TV season, which was expected to be $20 to $21 billion in this 2021 TV season, will fall to $14 billion. That is a staggering, staggering fall. It predicts somewhat of a recovery the following year in 21-22, but that is a big number. And, you know, this industry is taking shots, like painful, painful shots in all aspects of the entertainment business.
Yeah, that's not just a, you know, wow, we're down this year. That is a catastrophic 25, 27% drop. That's layoffs. That's consolidation. That's, you know, things are going to change in the TV business if that comes true. And you see it in the way that these network conglomerates are approaching the upfronts. They are desperately trying to generate any kind of attention they can. I mean, we saw this past week, NBC announced that they're doing a 30 Rock reunion for upfront buyers. And they're not just doing it for the buyers, they're actually going to air it on NBC, which begs the question of, you know, whether viewers in Decatur or Chicago are going to watch this and be like, wait, what's an upfront? But they're actually putting their upfront pitch in the form of a 30 Rock special on NBC and Peacock and their digital platform. So this just shows you how much they are scared of what's going on, how much they're trying to scramble and salvage any advertising they can.
Yes. At the same time, we are seeing big changes in terms of the Oscars. And of course, this goes to ABC and something that it very much depends on for its revenues. The Oscars have pushed the date of the ceremony and extended the eligibility period for films. Normally, the eligibility period is at the end of the calendar year. Now it's been extended to February 28th, 2021. And the ceremony itself has been pushed from February 28th to April 25th. What that then means we can have, they say they're going to have a ceremony, the normal ceremony at a theater, we'll see. This is not the first time this has happened. It happened in 1938 because of LA flooding, in 1968 because of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and in 1981 because of the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan. So I think it's fair to say when the Oscars push terrible things are happening in the world, from a business perspective, this is a terrible thing, as I said, for ABC.
The ramifications here are twofold. One, you know, this is a big deal for ABC because they made about $140, $150 million on advertising last year's in the Oscars alone. It is their Super Bowl that they count on. They pay a lot of money for these rights. And now that revenue they count on for Q1 is going to be pushed to Q2 if it happens at all. I mean, keep in mind, we're still operating under an assumption here that live events are going to come back because we have no idea whether celebrities are going to be able to walk a red carpet or even a toned down, muted ceremony is going to be able to happen even next April. The second ramification here is for the traditional studio release patterns, because the logjam at the end of the year for these awards movies is usually pretty significant. And there's that corridor where you just release the movie, hope you get the critics awards, hope you get the awards momentum, and then you ride the box office through the Oscars. Now, when you push the Oscars into late April, the studios, I think, are going to start to shift their releases and put movies in that January, February, March corridor that usually don't go there. Some of these more prestigious films, the awards-oriented ones. And that's assuming that movies do come back and that we get to actually see movies in theaters, which is a big assumption as well. But if so, it's going to really change the way that studios approach this release pattern.
Yeah, we've got uncertainty on top of uncertainty here. So far, the studios and the theaters are clinging to July as a return to seeing movies in theaters. Warner's did move Tenet 2 weeks. I don't know what that accomplished, except that the Christopher Nolan movie is now not the first one going into theaters with this pandemic, the first brand new big ticket movie. But we'll see. July is, we're seeing a lot of spikes in places that have opened up. So, I don't know that this is realistic, and nobody else knows either. The other thing the Academy has mentioned is that it's going to create a diversity requirement for eligibility. This immediately got a lot of people thinking, well, what is that going to be? And I want to give the Academy credit for, having really worked to diversify its membership. But creating a diversity requirement for films, look, I'm not against the goal. I just think it's the kind of thing that's incredibly fraught and seems destined to lead to a potentially great controversy.
Yeah, yet again, the Academy announced a big, bold proposition here, much like they did with the popular Oscar that was going to honor commercial films. This is a big deal. The Academy has always said that it's not their fault that Hollywood is not diverse. They're just honoring the movies that are made. Now they're taking an affirmative step to say, we will not honor films that do not adhere to a diversity standard, but they have yet to say what that is. So that's a big question mark.
Yeah, I will give them credit for their efforts, again, to diversify. Parasite probably won because of diversity efforts and opening up that old white membership that had been the cause for Oscars so white. There's just I'm not against this goal at all. There's so much work to be done in Hollywood. Will Packer, the producer of Girls Trip, spotlighted a problem that, has been totally, I think, ignored by Hollywood, which is, he had a general point of view that he wrote in an essay in The Hollywood Reporter that's very much worth reading. But what really caught my eye is when he talked about his goal of trying to get Hollywood to support anti-hate crime legislation in Georgia, where so much production, where those sweet tax credits call to so many studios to do production there. And he wrote, and I'm quoting, "It's easy for my West Coast friends to forget sometimes that Atlanta is a city that happens to be inextricably linked to a whole lot of smaller towns and counties that surround it. The state, many of these areas are where Confederate flags and anti-women's rights sentiments fly in church parking lots." And he points very recently to the Ahmaud Arbery murderers who spewed a racial epithet over his dead body, as Will Packer writes, just a few hours from where T'Challa and the rest of the Avengers were filmed saving the world. We've seen a lot of stuff in Georgia that could use some anti-hate legislation. The recent election, there's a lot of trouble in Georgia, and Will Packer makes this point that Hollywood enjoys the tax credits and just kind of looks the other way on all this other stuff.
Yeah, and there was a little bit of noise around some of the proposed anti-abortion legislation that was coming out of Georgia. And yet there hasn't been much of a focus on Georgia from Hollywood's perspective during the recent attention on police shootings and Black Lives Matter. And, when you look at the amount of money that is spent, and I recently was perusing some of the charts last year on where the spends went, it's California, it's New York, and then it's Georgia now. There is so much production going on because of their aggressive tax credits that Will Packer is right. There needs to be a focus on what kind of an environment Hollywood is supporting when they shoot films there.
Yeah, it's really something where Hollywood needs to put its muscle kind of where its mouth is. We see a lot of lip service, but we need to see more action and not just statements from the heads of companies. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In the new dramedy, The King of Staten Island, Pete Davidson plays Scott, a stoner in his 20s who lives at home with his mom. He's been stuck in a state of arrested development ever since his firefighter father was killed on the job when Scott was a little boy. Scott says he wants to become a tattoo artist, and his friends have been supportive, letting him use their bodies to practice with extremely mixed results. Even his good friend Rich, played by Lou Wilson, has hit his limit after a presidential portrait went terribly awry.
I need somebody to tattoo. I'm running out of... Come on, Rich, what about you,
man? Don't even look at me, dude.
Why?
Your work is mad inconsistent. Obama ain't right.
I got the eyes wrong, okay?
He's not right. All right, man, this has hurt me. Right? I don't have any black friends anymore. I can't go to the barbershop no more. You got Obama wrong. Ain't nothing worse than that.
Scott is not at all happy when his mom starts dating a firefighter. But eventually they try to bond, and Scott ends up hanging out and doing odd jobs at the station, the same one where his dad once worked. Firehouse patriarch Papa, played by Steve Buscemi, can't help but be charmed by Scott, even as he gripes about washing the fire truck.
Why do we have to clean this thing anyway? It's just going to get fire on it. You think the people that are burning alive give a f*** if the truck is shiny? Just saying. I don't even know why you gotta clean the truck. When you're trying to show up all sexy to a fire?
I like him.
The King of Staten Island is inspired by Davidson's real life. His father was one of more than 300 firefighters who died on September 11th when Davidson was just 8 years old. Davidson, who's now a regular on Saturday Night Live, co-wrote the script with our guest, Judd Apatow, who directed the film. Apatow, of course, is a comedy icon. He directed 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Trainwreck, and he's produced dozens of other projects, including Bridesmaids and Girls. Eagle-eyed viewers may recall that The King of Staten Island isn't technically the first time Apatow and Davidson have worked together. Davidson has a fleeting part in the Amy Schumer film Trainwreck. This was before he landed the gig on Saturday Night Live, but Apatow saw that Davidson had potential.
You know, Richard Dreyfuss in The Graduate, he has one line at the door, and you're always like, wow, that was Richard Dreyfuss. He had one line in The Graduate. I always love that as just a fan of movies. Mm-hmm. Just seeing somebody with not much to do. So every right. once in a while, we don't have the great part for someone, but we think, I think that person's going to be a giant star. It would be funny if they had very little to do in our movie.
Right.
So, you know, we didn't have anything great for Pete, but we were like, he's going to be a big star. Let's just have him do this thing. And a lot of times we try to think of something to do later. You know, Kevin Hart's in The 40-Year-Old Virgin yelling at Romany Malco. And there's so many people who've popped up over the years who've gone on to amazing things. Nick Kroll is so funny in Get Him to the Greek, and on and on. I mean, we love that.
I have to admit, I was really surprised. And I guess I'm not the only one. Pete Davidson can really act.
Yes, he's a fantastic actor. I think that he is a natural. He's very comfortable, very present. And it was really fun directing him because he's right there. And I think that's what he's like as a person. He's transparent. He lets you know how he's feeling, for good or bad.
Yeah.
You know, he's not gonna lie about what he's experiencing. And that's how he's dealt with his whole life, is to not have that layer of BS. He's not gonna put on airs for anybody. He's just gonna be himself. And it's actually incredibly refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he obviously has had his reputation and the rumors. I read somewhere you said that you think that was exaggerated. Is that what you really think, though?
It's not that they were exaggerated. I just think that people know so little about the truth of it. You know, people hear things through a very narrow lens. People don't have access to his life and what's going on and how he's doing. And obviously, he's had great trauma and he's fought to be healthy and he certainly struggled. And I think that what he does in his life is very hard. He's facing the toughest stuff of all. And he's also working on it through his art. He's writing about it. He's looking at it from every possible angle. And I think it helps him. It's a cathartic experience to write like the other people in your life. You know what I mean? Like, he's not just writing his character. He's writing his mom's character. He's writing his sister's character. And I think there's something really healthy about stepping into everyone's shoes in your life and thinking about how everybody managed this loss.
Yes. And I guess he did try to bail right before the movie started shooting. He was sending you ideas about who else could play that role.
Oh, yeah. One day we start getting these emails the weekend before shooting was supposed to start. And it was just IMDb resumes of different actors. It would be like Emil Hirsch or, you know, Tobey Maguire. And it was his way of saying, maybe somebody else should play my part. And I thought he was joking, and I just started laughing. And they just kept coming in. And then on the set, I'm like, that was so funny. And he's like, I wasn't kidding at all. I really wanted you to hire those people.
So you got him back, obviously.
Well, he never left. But I think it was an expression, comedically and seriously, of, you know, the fear of starting up. Once it started, we had actually kind of a great shoot, and we really enjoyed it. There were only a few days that were a bit intense. And I think those scenes came out so well that they turned into very positive days where at the end of the day, we accomplished what we were trying to do.
Right. Such relief. I actually didn't know, kind of a fun fact, that Steve Buscemi was a firefighter.
He was a firefighter in the early 80s in Little Italy before his acting career took off. And he stayed very close with the firefighting community. He supports this charity, Friends of Firefighters, which supports the families of lost firefighters. And he also went down to Ground Zero after 9/11 and took part in the cleanup for a long time. And he's just the best, Steve Buscemi.
I feel like he looks like he could be related to Pete Davidson, like he could be his uncle or something in real life. It just has this sort of, there's some sort of through line between those two. Maybe I'm the only one who sees that. You can tell me if you think I'm crazy.
Well, he is the character that quietly is looking after Pete. And he speaks a lot of the wisdom to Pete. Well, the funny thing is, when we were trying to research the world of tattooing, one thing that kept coming up, that getting a tattoo of Steve Buscemi is a very popular thing to do.
Get out. That is not true. It is.
So, and they're amazing. All his characters from all these cool, like, Coen Brothers movies, people love getting tattoos of Steve Buscemi.
I had no idea. Did you cast him because you knew he had the firefighting experience, or was that random?
It was because he's one of our favorite actors of all time, but we also felt that his firefighting experience would inform that part, that he just so understands that world. And he's also a very kind man. And the world of firefighters is really filled with a lot of kind of warm, gentle souls. You know, I asked this one firefighter when I was doing research if a lot of the work was boring, or do you get sent out on a lot of calls that are kind of nothing, where you're helping someone find their cat or somebody tripped or something. And the man said to me, Judd, you know, I know this sounds corny, but we just love helping people. And that was the spirit that I felt among all the firefighters that we met along the way.
Coming up after a short break, Judd Apatow explains why he was okay with releasing his new movie on demand instead of holding out for a theatrical release. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to comedy multi-hyphenate Judd Apatow. His new movie, The King of Staten Island, is now available on demand. The original plan was for The King of Staten Island to get a theatrical release, but then the pandemic hit.
We had two decisions. We could either wait a really long time to put it out. There's clearly going to be some sort of pileup of big movies in the future. And we could compete with all of these action movies and spectacle movies. Or we could release it right now on video on demand. And I quickly decided that our movie is meant to bring people pleasure. It's meant to make you happy. It's the only reason why we make it. We want people to, you know, feel these emotions. And our movie is about loss and grief. And it's also about heroes and firefighters and nurses and first responders. And it just occurred to me, I think this movie was kind of destined to come out in this moment. I think it's helpful to people. I hope it's really funny. And then I just felt really good about it. We did test it. We had that experience in theaters where we got the big laughs, and that was all very exciting. But I also think it's an intimate movie that plays well in people's homes. And, you know, it's certainly a weird way to do it. But on a lot of levels, I've come to really like it. And I'm excited to get it out there.
Yeah, it's I understand not wanting. I mean, I assume everybody was on the same page and Pete didn't say, no, I want my big screen moment. Or did he?
No. In fact, Pete, the second everyone started isolating, was like, well, let's get it out there right now. He was a big proponent months before I was talking about how to do that. He was excited for people to see it. He had zero resistance because we did want people to get something out of the movie. This isn't a movie that was really created as a product. It is a man expressing something deeply personal and offering something up that I think is very generous, and it's a hard place for him to go. And it was never about, you know, how much money could we milk out of this thing. We were never interested in that.
But it does raise some sticky, not just your movie, but anything that goes to on-demand, sticky financial questions. You know, I did a story for The Hollywood Reporter about how they put Trolls on Demand and somehow forgot to tell Justin Timberlake that they were doing it in a timely fashion, and Anna Kendrick. So I don't know if that came up on a movie of this size, but obviously with box office, there's a very clear metric that it made this many dollars. So if you're a profit participant, at some point you get money. Whereas with on demand, the data isn't even very good.
Yeah, none of that was an issue. It really wasn't. I've been working with Universal for 20 years now. I have a really long, strong relationship with them. And that's not the stuff that gets complicated. It really was about, you know, did I feel comfortable doing it this way? And they certainly were not pushing to do something that I didn't want to do. I really wanted to do it and thought that this was the appropriate way to go for this very unique moment in time. Obviously, I want to make comedies for the theaters, but I've made movies that are not for the theaters. I produced a movie called Pee-wee's Big Holiday for Netflix. It was the second original movie that aired on Netflix. And we had a fantastic time. And sometimes that is the best way to do something. So I think in the future, it's going to be a grab bag of all different types of distribution. I don't think how it can be anything but that.
It's harder, though, for comedies now. And I think a lot of people feel that the streaming services have something to do with that, that they've sort of trained people to watch comedy in your house, which is almost completely the opposite of what is, I would imagine, any comedy filmmaker would want.
I really don't think that's the case. I think that if someone made a great comedy like Something About Mary right now, it would be giant, just like Something About Mary was. It's very, very rare that someone makes a fantastic comedy that doesn't do very well. There are exceptions, but for the most part, there's still a lot of comedies that make a lot of money. Now, maybe people find out quicker if you've made a mediocre or a bad movie, because in the old days, you would wait on the reviews. And other than that, there was no social media. There was no way for people to tell each other quickly, hey, don't see that. That's terrible. Mm-hmm. So right now, people can instantly spread the word to run from your movie if you didn't make a great movie. And I don't think that's really about streaming. I think it's more about Twitter and social media. But when something's great, it tends to do great.
Yeah, I'm assuming, though, that it's a harder green light at this point from a studio.
I think that the studios have a certain amount of money to make movies every year. And there's definitely a lot of big bets that are placed on movies that they hope make like $600 to $1 billion.
Right.
And comedies are rarely in that world. But those are also scary bets that have a lot of risk. So most studios, they want comedies. They want horror movies. They want those bets. I think maybe there's a little more concern about the budgets because the DVD money disappeared that mm-hmm. used to come in when they sold so many DVDs. But that also seems to be rebounding as streaming becomes more of a big market and digital downloads get bigger.
Yeah, that's something that the pandemic is actually training people to do. Now, I see you most often, of course, on Twitter. You see me and I see you. You are very not playing for comedy on Twitter. It's not a moment where you think things are funny.
I know, and that's a drag about Twitter is, you know, the world is a very serious place right now. There's a lot going on that is so important, and Twitter started as a fun place to make jokes and talk about your stand-up tours and all of that, and there's some of that, but I think that we're also terrified because our president is clearly so dangerous and inept that it does feel like we need to get serious about what are we going to do to be a positive force against all of this negativity.
Right. You don't spare Lachlan Murdoch at all. You have a special target too, as Fox, as I know I've tweeted about Fox News and we've talked about it on the show.
Well, I have a very simple theory about life, which is you're either putting something positive in the world or you're putting something negative into the world. And we all decide what we do for a living. We all decide how we make our money, and we have to make ethical choices. And when you're the person in charge of a network that has people on it saying things which discourage people from wearing masks, which spreads disease, which leads people to dying, or you have people on air saying things that are racist and anti-immigrant, I think that people need to know, okay, well, someone owns this network and somebody hires those people who are the talking heads who say these horrible things, who are hypnotizing part of the country, and people should know his name. And I couldn't find it more troubling that our business gives everyone a free ride on that. It really is disappointing. It's the worst of Hollywood is that more people don't call that out.
Yes, I personally am surprised that there is so much silence, but you know, there's they don't own Fox, the films and TV studio anymore, but they still own a network, and maybe courage is something that is in short supply because people think, well, I need a paycheck and the business is, you know, contracting or transforming, and they just don't want to take on that battle, I guess, but you're not in that camp.
I don't know what it takes for people to stand up for things, and it's great that it's happening in America right now, but you know, the silence on most issues is really shocking. That's one thing that I've noticed. When you just see who the voices are, who's speaking up, who's not, you know, there are a lot of people who complain about liberal Hollywood and their opinions, but when you really get down to it, almost no one is speaking up. I think that people wait to speak up until they see there's some cover in everybody else speaking up.
Yeah.
And I get it. But I also think there's a lot of people who have the ability to speak up who make a very conscious choice not to speak up.
Disappointing.
I find it shocking. I couldn't find it more disappointing. Everything that's happening now, we knew was going to happen. A lot of people have said, this is where this all ends with this president. And it's happening. It's happening right before our eyes.
Not a lot of comedy in that.
there isn't. That's why I'm not funny on Twitter. And I was just not funny there. And you got me to prove my point.
Judd Apatow's new film, The King of Staten Island, is now available on video on demand. Thank you, Judd.
Thank you.
That's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help from Kevin Tidmarsh and Mario Diaz. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.